Good morning, everybody. It is the 15th of August. It is time for another live burning platform here on the podcast party. And I'm thrilled. First of all, we've got a great guest, but I'm thrilled to welcome back to the burning platform. People thought something terrible had happened, but she's here and she's back in full force. None other than Pumelele Mashiro.
I'm here this morning already. Very cutesy. Very cutesy. Very demure. Very... Alive.
I've missed you, and I'm pleased to see that you're well and you're ready to rejoin us and start pushing people for answers and getting the answers we deserve, and that's what we do on the Burning Platform. So
listen, and it's like what a crazy time we are living in. I'm glad, like sorry guys, every single day. I wake up and I go, what happened in the 6 hours that I have been sleeping? And well, without a doubt, there's always it's always going down.
And it's amazing to me. I was talking to Jack about this earlier because in the space of a day or a week, the news cycle changes so dramatically that it almost doesn't even matter what happened the week before. I mean, you know, you have major, major world events and then within days, people have completely forgotten about them and moved on. And you know, things like the attempted assassination of a presidential candidate, just forgot. That was a month ago. No one's talking about Russia-Ukraine at the moment. And it's an ongoing war at the highest levels, which could spill over into a much, much bigger conflict. We've been warned about this for ages. And nobody's talking about it. And then... You know, there's Israel and Iran and it's unbelievable.
I think everyone today's show is actually quite prescient, and I'm quite looking forward to it because for the past 2 weeks, literally, we have all been sitting on edge, waiting. Is there like a world war coming? Are the nuclear weapons? Is Iran getting into the fight? Is America coming? Every day we're just like, is today the day? We wake up in the morning and is today the day? Missiles over Tel Aviv. What's going to happen next?
I certainly hope not, but I do want to reiterate what I've said to people who listen to the show often enough, friends of mine, family. I've made one or two speeches about this where I've been asked to talk somewhere. I'm certainly not absconding our responsibilities to the rest of the world, but this is not a bad place to be if, you know, the shit hits the fan. I really think like we should be very we should be very grateful that we have our problems because the other people's problems are always worse than your own. So
except our problems, I mean, and our problems are also like that, right? We're all on a knife edge at every moment. We don't know what's coming around the corner, what kind of, and how the scale of it, right? the scale at which it will come. And we've had one or two scares. I don't think we're going to be in an all-out war or have ISIS or ISIL or, you know, at our doorstep, but
well, I got bad news for you because
it's not Mozambique, that far away.
Mozambique is just one country away, and they're there, so just be careful,
Karen. And I thought literally the afternoon after we were with Mandy, because that's the last show that I did, and I said to you guys, there's chaos on the streets of Bangladesh, and in the afternoon they had ousted the prime minister, she'd fled the country.
Right.
Like this is, everybody is, there's definitely something in the air. We all hate each other right now.
Well, Bitcoin Butt says in the comments, morning, what a lacquer interview you did with Brigitte Gabriel. If you haven't checked it out yet, it is a must. She basically explained why and how England is failing because she lived it in Lebanon. Well, I added the in Lebanon because I don't think you don't want to confuse people, make them think that she was in England. But yes, no, that's spot on. And if you haven't watched that, please take a look because, wow, is she passionate. I mean, she's one of the most passionate people I've ever interviewed.
I love that.
I felt like she shouted at me for 45 minutes.
I love that what she said about the passionate people will overrun.
And she's right. You know, if you ever think we can't do things because we aren't the majority in any situation, forget about it. She's 100% correct. And when she first said that, which was in the mid-2000s, I saw a clip of her and I thought, you know what? This woman is smart. And it's taken me that long. Well done to Sia Sangweni, because he managed to get her for us. And she's fantastic. I mean, she delivered in every way I'd hoped. Okay, so I do want us to get to our guest, because I do think we're going to have a fascinating conversation this morning about all kinds of things that are not only relevant and interesting to the situation we find ourselves in the world right now, but of course the central tent peg of so much of this is conflict, right? And conflict is just what happens when two or more people are in each other's orbit. There's bound to be conflict, conflict over space, resources, loudness, power, authority, influence, all of those things come into play. And the resolution of these conflicts isn't always clear. And so we're going to ask for someone to assist us to get to the bottom of how these things happen and how we can resolve them. It is none other than, and if you've stumbled upon him on social media, you'll know he's very outspoken, a conflict resolution specialist, a mediator and an author, and his name is André Flock. André, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Morning. So nice to see you. And
the person behind the tweets. Do we still yes. call them tweets? Or is there another word now?
There'll always be tweets, I'm sure.
Welcome.
André, I'm not even sure where we should begin, but perhaps let's start here at home in South Africa, because, I mean, conflict is it's a broad category of things, and our cities in South Africa seem more or less stable. I mean, we have our problems. Back in 2021, we, of course, had those riots. Are we vulnerable to urban conflict like we see in the UK with these riots that are going on there and people who are fighting and arguing and protesting in the streets? And there is a fair amount of like police activity going on there too.
We're extremely vulnerable. I'm still trying to get my head around why we are different. All the conflict causes, all the triggers that we see in the UK, that we see in Bangladesh, that we see in Paris, are here. We have the exact same dominoes lined up as those places, and yet, with the exception of 21, we've managed to do quite well so far. I'm less confident that we're going to keep it that way. I think we have some of that in our immediate future, and we certainly need to work with that.
Why do you say that? Because I thought we were entering a period now of almost a little more stability rather than a little more chaos. You know, MK have shot their shot and it hasn't really rung around the country as loud as they'd wanted to. It's become a home for the dispossessed and the miserable under Jacob Zuma. And it's really a party with one purpose, and that is to keep the people in that party out of jail, or to allow them to keep on milking from the public purse in small or big ways. And largely that's what those riots in 2021 were all about. The cities aren't wonderful. I mean, Johannesburg certainly has major problems, and Gwamanda this week resigned a little too late, if you ask me. His party had the cheek, by the way, Pumi, don't laugh. His party had the cheek. Aljamar, the leader of Aljamar, came out and said, Gwamanda must be allowed to continue his work. And I thought to myself, what work? Yeah, I mean, Durban is a clusterfuck. We know that. But, you know, largely, I mean, I drove through PE the other day, which is also not a great place in South Africa and isn't being run, let's say, optimally. No. But I don't get the feeling like these places are tinderboxes.
May you be right. May a year from now, I want you to call me and say, "Yeah, you were wrong." What worries me is that we are slower than a lot of these. The UK, Europe, much of Europe, much of the old Eastern Europe have been here where we are now. That period of hope, that period of the GNU, the period of the last roll of the dice, let's give democracy another chance. What I see and what concerns me is if democracy fails, what we see in Europe, what we see in Asia, are frustrated people, people that are isolated, people that are not feeling heard. And they take to the streets, and that's where urban conflict becomes that tinderbox. And that, those are the early signs that concern me. We shouldn't, because we have a government of national unity. I hope with the rest of the country that it works. But if it doesn't, we certainly have all the triggers, all the conflict causes that the rest of the world that we've seen have in spades, and then some. High unemployment, a youth unemployment, a youth that's very disillusioned with democracy, with the so-called Western way of doing things. Those are the things. I'm not being negative. Those are my concerns.
Well, one of the things that I'm looking at and wondering, and over the past couple of weeks, I think we've seen it spike again, which just before the election, there were waves of it. So people and organizations like an Operation Tutula, for instance, in Soweto, and the way that they organize and how they then, you know, voice their discontent. What is it that, in your view, makes organizations like that, if at all, something that we need to be careful of, that we need to look at and watch out for?
That's a great point, Bumi, because that's the toxic mix of that takes us to the edge. We're living on an edge. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, everything is we've done pretty well with our election. Immigration is a problem that is there. It's here in South Africa, globally, we're just not dealing with it. We are, when we do deal, when our leaders, when our political leaders deal with it, we do so very badly. We are building up frustration. We are trying to put a lid on the problem. We're not dealing with it. This is a conflict that's building and building and building, and it has a lot of input. It has a lot of causes. It has a lot of energy that's simply not being dealt with. So here in South Africa, if there's a single trigger, there never is, but if there is a single trigger that's going to cause trouble, it would be immigration.
So a couple of months ago, just before the election, Thabo Mbeki gave that big public lecture. Gareth, you and I were there. And one of the things he spoke about with the 2021 riots, which at the moment when he said it, I couldn't believe that he said that out loud, that there has been a collapse of state infrastructure with regard to responding to such threats, but also even before such a thing happens, the apparatus of state that is supposed to be looking out for these things and being proactive about kind of identifying hotspots, sending the right people to diffuse those kinds of hotspots. Do you think that as South Africa, when the government is not properly primed, properly prepared to respond?
Very much. I get into trouble for saying this every now and then. Our political leaders simply have no clue how this works, how the conflict, the principles behind it work. We keep on dealing with the symptoms like a bad doctor. We deal with what we see in the press. We, you know, Gaten McKenzie says things and then we respond, and the same tired old debates go round and round. This is identity conflict. These are people who, the people who complain about this, the people who are seen as the problem, Are the people whose conflicts are not being dealt with? If I was the king of the country, I would certainly not. It's not so much about whether we're prepared and whether we have law enforcement, all those things. This is a problem. This is a conflict that could, and quite easily and quite inexpensively, can be addressed and resolved way earlier upstream. Before
what do you mean by that?
What is it? If let's picture a situation where all or most South Africans are reasonably secure, they have a job, their families are taken care of, their work is rewarded, they relatively in modern terms they're stable and secure. Would we still say the same things about foreigners? Would we still feel that way? Now we see an interesting thing. If the government understands identity conflicts, why we respond to this the way we do? We feel threatened. We feel worried, concerned, and now we say stupid things, and we feel threatened about the foreigner, the other, the outsider. Either there's a, let's take it a step back. There's a clever way, a scientific way, a modern conflict resolution way of dealing with immigration, with the identity conflicts that this involves. Now, either the government doesn't, and I'm not picking on just ours. You see that in Europe. You see that you see it in the United States. Either you don't know how to persuade people earlier on, before it gets out of hand, before we see trouble in the streets. Either you don't know how to do that, which raises questions all by itself, or even more concerning, our governments, our political leaders know how to do this properly and still they don't do it. Still they don't deal with immigration and those complex identity conflicts involved in that. They do know how to address it. They do know how to persuade people. They do know how to get people more comfortable with it, and yet they don't. Why would they do that? Yeah, and that opens a few different conflict topics.
It works for the politicians to stoke these kinds of fears in people. I mean, it's one of, and we've spoken about this on the show quite, that South Africans
to divide.
Most of us, on an interpersonal level, we live quite comfortably next to each other. And all it really is every now and again having these charismatic leaders within within communities who want to exploit this thing, this popularism, whatever it is that people are feeling uneasy about. And there's no way to divorce the fact that our economic strife in the country, so our high unemployment rate, which means we have lots of people who have nothing to do, but also lots of people living in desperate situations, is one of the biggest causes of the conflicts that we see in townships, particularly, you know, within the townships, because then they're kind of going, why are the Pakistanis able to have a spaza shop and we can't? Why, you know?
Are you starting to see why I'm concerned?
No, well, I'm not, and I'll explain why, because Pumi's kind of hit on it here, but I also think that we're not people who are as prone to outbreaks of organized violence as most. I also look at it as an osmotic kind of thing. There's a pressure, certain amount of salt in the water here, and there's less salt in the water here, so there's a gradual movement of molecules to this side. What I mean is the people are coming. Yeah, I mean, the people who are coming to South Africa from other places, those places are even more shit than anything that we have. You know, if a Somalian is in South Africa, that's not because Somalia is great and their economy is working and unemployment is much, much lower and they can ply their trade there. They're coming here because this is where the opportunities are. And yes, it's tough, but South Africa is not the toughest place in the world. You know, our winters are never so cold that you'll freeze to death outside and not make it through the night. And our summers are never so hot that you'll burn to death in the sun. We have natural resources. There's quite a lot of space, even though in certain places it's very concentrated. And I think crucially, we don't have the organizing principles, unless there is a Operation Dudula or something like that. I don't see people actually being able to get together and make things happen, especially these unemployed youths. Because
They don't need big organization, Gareth.
No, but Pums.
It's simply me. What we see in the UK, in the streets in the UK, what we saw in Bangladesh, and what we see happen time and again in this country is that a small group of people, I mean, they're whatever, 50, 100 Dudula people, but all it takes is that chaos to take root, which is what happened in 2021. And then many opportunistic people, and that is what overruns the system. If you remember the footage of what we saw in 2021, the people looting the stores, those people didn't arrive there on a bus or as part of the organized. They just saw an opportunity, and now people are stealing TVs. Very famously, the guy with the Woolworths basket. I mean, the man was in a bloody Mercedes Benz, and he still stopped his car, and he still went to loot a small basket of Woolworths. That guy isn't part of any kind of organized anything. It's simply when the chaos takes root, like all kinds of fights and wars, is when it starts, it's like a storm. It's like a storm. You don't know where it's going or when it will end, especially when you don't that knows how to deal with it.
Would all three of us not have laughed at someone speculating about what we're seeing in the UK, say 2 months ago? It really seems
no, I wouldn't have. I'll tell you why. I could see that coming a long time ago, because you see, I think it's different. I don't think it's the same. I think what they're dealing with in Europe is what you hinted at earlier on. When you said, Andre, that it's an identity crisis, their culture is under threat from the illegal immigrants. Now, I don't think our culture is under threat. That's where I think there's a difference. I certainly think we have extenuating circumstances like unemployment and like the fact that the economy is not growing and the fact that there are so many people under the poverty line, et cetera, et cetera. Those are obviously big problems. The UK doesn't have any of those aforementioned problems that I went through now. They have unemployment, but it's very, very low. And what they've got is a welfare state that's like a big safety net that catches everybody who falls down. Unfortunately, too many of the British are actually just used to sitting around and letting migrants do the work. And that's part of the problem too. But it's because these people come in, they don't assimilate, they continue to prioritize their own culture, religion, language over being British, and yet they've moved to Britain. So for the average Brit, they're looking at this going, why did you come here if you want to stay Pakistani or Afghanistani or Syrian? I don't get it.
Do we not hear the same here? Do we not hear echoes of that yet?
I mean, we see it in small pockets, but it's more of a material thing than it is a cultural thing. I really think so. I mean, in the townships, you don't have people who are deliberately anti someone because of their language or religion. That's not a very South African thing. I think it's because they've opened the shop.
But also, we watched over the past month, all the way up to ministerial level, starting on social media, simply because this girl's name is Chidima, and you know, suddenly somebody is saying, oh, this person's not South African. Why is this person part of this competition that is for South Africans? It's the same thing. It's the same thing.
Again, I'm not saying we are going to have trouble with that. I'm saying it's highly likely. I'm saying I'm concerned about it. I'm saying that we to get back to this pressure cooker idea, we have, on the one hand, we have people who are starting to become more and more disillusioned with a series of decades of promises. Vote for me one more time. Well, you know, the job's coming. This will improve, that will improve, we'll stop stealing, we'll be better political leaders. And on the other hand, I think what we're starting to see here, and Gareth, this is one of the things that's pushing from the other side, creating that pressure. We are seeing, like in the UK, we're seeing that, and it's a leadership failure, where people are starting to be criticized for speaking out on very legitimate conflict problems and concerns about their jobs, about limited resources going to people that they regard as outsiders. And to now call them xenophobic, to now, like in the UK, call them far right, ultra-conservative, fascists, all those things. That's really playing with matches around a big drum of petrol. And we've seen the start of that here as well.
I do agree with that, and I think that that's a very stupid move by the UK government in particular to try and shut down that kind of conversation. I just think that when you look at the average unemployed young person in South Africa, they can't even get up and go to the polling station, let alone get up and brandish a weapon or set fire to something. These are some of the laziest people, and I'm not you know, going into details about the individuals here, but as a group, and Pumi, you and I spoke about this after the election. We were doing all kinds of programs to reach out to young people. When you meet them one-on-one, they can sometimes be hugely impressive. No, well, this is what we want. This is how, how we see the world. They're educated, and certainly more educated than the population of South Africa has ever been, thanks to the old regime and the level of education that they gave us. But these are, as a group, the least motivated people ever. And I don't see them being able to bring about change. If anything, it's people older than them that will bring about that change at this stage. And until it gets so desperate that they'll get up off their backsides and A, go and vote, or B, take up an actual cause, I don't see much change happening for them.
Do you not see, do we not see for the first time in an election, we have immigration and the so-called real or perceived problems created by that as a very real platform? It was a popular platform in this election. There's pressure building here. It's just coming slower than in Europe.
Well, it didn't help Herman Mashaba. It didn't help. Gayton McKenzie certainly made a good turnout, but I think that was largely because he's given a home to coloured voters who would identify with that before anything else. He might have got a lot of white support and a lot of black support too. But Herman Mashaba was like the guy who was talking about the illegal immigrants, and it didn't help him.
Well, how many people do we need to start serious urban conflict? Not 51% of the voting public.
Sure.
We need a volatile, bad group of people, really frustrated people who feel rightly or wrongly that they've run out of options, that democracy is not working, that employment's not working, that all these promises are taking them nowhere. People who take part in serious urban conflict are by the by, and there's a ton of case studies on it. They're not bad people. They're simply people who feel unheard. This, I don't want to do this, but I have to do it for me, for a future. There's nothing else. I have nothing to lose. And I think we've got an awful component, an awfully large component of that in South Africa. I'm not saying this will happen later this afternoon. I hope that it never happens. I'm writing a book on urban conflict, and one of the chapters in there that I struggle with terribly is this input of migration across the world. We try and you know, when the Olympics come, we clean up the area, we criminalize saying bad things and uncomfortable things about migration and people living on the streets. We are not our leaders, but to a large extent us as well. We're not dealing with immigration. We cannot have. It's a work in progress, so you'll have to read the chapter on it. I'm still struggling with this in my own head. But we cannot have limitless open borders. We cannot just, as wonderful as it sounds, we cannot just welcome the world to countries with their own modern problems, to their own, you know, with their own internal conflicts. That is creating, for one moment, ask me, all right, so what's the solution? I simply don't know. Every country will have to deal with this in their own way. But certainly this open border, send me your poor and your weak.
I
think those days are
dangerous.
And we need, our leaders need to upskill their conflict skills so that they can deal with this properly. This is identity conflicts writ large, and it's going to create problems that are unrelated, as we see around here, unrelated to immigration.
Yeah.
Andre, as a person who looks at urban conflict all over the world, not just in South Africa, what are the similarities in terms of, because what I see happening here in South Africa is I see it as a conflict over resource. So because the resource of work, therefore money and all the access that comes with it is so diminished that when people, as Gareth says, a person who's left Ethiopia, Somalia, wherever in the world to come here is because they see better opportunity here than there. But when we're saying the opportunity is not there, it's not there for South Africans, it's certainly not going to be there for additional people who come, right? Similarly, all over the world, if I think about what happened in Bangladesh, this again, that conflict was around resource, right? It was around allocation of work opportunities for students. That's why the students took to the streets. Where all over the world, all of this conflict really is around resources and the lack thereof. Are there any other reasons that create these kinds of conflicts outside of that? So if we fix our unemployment, if we fix our economy, does the conflict go away?
How's it bad?
No, it doesn't.
Good. I'm just doing.
What's happening? Andre, you can continue. I don't know what Gareth is trying to fix on the backside there.
All right. Probably ordering coffee, hopefully. This time
That was my fault. Sorry about that. I tried to change the setting here and I obviously screwed things up. Go on.
not coffee then. Okay. Probably when we label it resources, we're a lot closer to the source of the problem. I've written extensively on identity conflicts, and that really, we'll need 10 hours to really discuss and unpack all those dominoes. But that is the key. That is the key. The resource argument, as complex as it is in its own right, is still a symptom. Is still downstream from identity conflicts. Now, identity conflicts is a wider concept than identity politics. Don't confuse the two. Identity conflicts has to do with me. I'm a father. I'm a blue ball supporter. I'm a white person. I'm a Zulu. All of those things. That's what is creating. All of those things are blurring, living in times where the old identities, the old structures are in trouble. We in South Africa, I think back to Gareth's original point, I think we're lucky in a negative way in that we don't really have as yet a true South African identity, or that's my perception. We still live as people from Gauteng, we still live as white Afrikaans people or English white people or Zulus or Sutus. There we find our identity, and that is under pressure. Yes, through resources, yes, through not getting our political ways, and that does change the spectrum of conflicts as we see in Europe, for example, but certainly resources, if we can fix that tomorrow, that helps with the identity, yes. But what our political leaders need to do is to understand identity conflicts and how to persuade people effectively. The case studies show, and this is part of where my concern comes from. If you approach identity conflicts in the wrong way, if you speak to people, if you try to persuade them the wrong way, such as calling them names, calling them xenophobic, telling them, trying to legislate your way out of the problem, that drives them deeper into their silos. That entrenches people in their positions, in their hostility, in their negative views of the other. So it's got way more to do with resources. Resources is a symptom. We need to keep an eye on that. It's complex work, all right? Our leaders would really need to roll up their sleeves. But resources, of course, needs to be dealt with. Perceptions, all those things, paperwork, the tech behind this, all of that needs to be addressed. But the first domino is identity conflicts.
So, Andre, I completely agree with you. I completely agree with you about the fact that these identity conflicts are becoming a thing globally. And I also agree with you that the open borders policies of some countries have been an absolute unmitigated disaster. It's also probably the number one issue in America right now. And in the lead up to this election, it appears that Kamala Harris, who changes her positions like her underwear, has decided that she's also tough on the border, which is exactly the opposite of what she's been up to now. So even completely open border lunatics on the left are starting to realize this is not something that works with the electorate. They're not happy with that. People in most countries in the world, however those countries may have been established, colonial borders back in the 1900s, states that were bought from the French in the 1800s, whatever it might have been, the countries that we have now, largely with a few separations and differences like in South Sudan, those are the countries that we're in, and we want to maintain our sovereignty of those countries. And I think the people who are charged with running the countries are not just unaccountable elites anymore. The public are holding their feet to the fire, and if they aren't feeling it yet, they will feel it soon. I think that's what you're saying about Europe. How do you see things in the rest of Africa? Because we have this interesting dichotomy in this continent, and I find myself sometimes backing the one side and sometimes backing the other. We've got people who say, this is a pan-African continent. We're all actually more similar than we are different, and we can work together and have trading blocks where we do all kinds of cool things like SADC and the rest of it. But then we've got people who say, no, we don't want any open borders, and we don't like working with Zimbabweans, and maybe the Tanzanians don't like working with us, and maybe we don't want the Nigerians here, or maybe the Nigerians don't want to work with us on a global level.
We don't even speak the same language as ECOWAS.
Correct. I mean, how does that unfold? Because it wasn't so long ago that Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma was at the head of the AU. It wasn't so long ago that Thabo Mbeki and Obasanjo started the AU from the OAU. Where are we now?
Africa's got as far as migration and just the whole open border thing, they've got far more complex problems than Europe has, if that is possible. Africa's running, I've done a specialist article for Routledge, one of the publications, now dealing with mediation and how we can try and deal with the problems of migration and so on. Gareth, I know it's still politically correct, and it still sounds wonderful to say that Africa is a continent and open borders and all of those things. It does not work, and it doesn't work not to be anti-woke or anything like that. It doesn't work economically. It doesn't work politically. It doesn't work religiously. It doesn't work socially. Africa's got an added problem in that Europe, to an extent, a relative extent, the borders are drawn sort of, they've had enough time to draw and redraw their borders, and the people who look and sound and eat the same stuff sort of live together. That's not the case in Africa. We've got colonial borders going back centuries, and we are forcing people to live together on top of all the economic problems, on top of tech problems that's growing. It's just an absolute mess waiting to happen, as we can see in the wars across the continent. Add to that, and it sort of underlines your point, the United Nations, I'm not happy to say this, but how effective are they nowadays? The African Union. All of these places that are there to assist with these questions are they more of a problem than an aid at this stage. Africa is looking at we're more polite. We Ubuntu plays a bigger role. I think we we have a different way across the continent, if I can generalize, of dealing with the other. We're more friendly, we're more effective in integrating people. But certainly we, again, here, we can't say that in Africa the open border approach will work. It doesn't, and it certainly it shouldn't. And political leaders trying to tell us that it is or build their future policies on it. Of course, the statistics are clear. Immigration done properly is a wonderful thing. It brings new skills. It really enlivens economies if you do it the correct way.
Andre, but I need to understand.
Opening the border, you know, that.
I have a question because I'm a little bit confused by what you're saying. That done properly, immigration or works and is a wonderful thing. But you're also saying, you know, open borders. So I need to understand what you mean by open borders, because if I think about the Euro-bloc, for instance, all you really need, and speaking about resource, which is why I talk about resource, is what you need is you need an ease of movement of people, money, and goods. You need to be able to easily trade with each other. pardon me. But where criminality is involved, where you've got corruption, where you've got illegal and unchecked movement of all those things too, right? People, money, and goods. Then you have got a problem. And how is it in your view, what is it that you are against? Are you against the fact that we need to be able to regulate the way that those three things move? Because we are not the same people, because we are different from each other? Or are you saying that we need to close up and be parochial and completely insulated and work with each other only with South Africans? And where do you draw the line, right, when you talk about identities and the differences of identities? Where is the similarity and the difference between a Mosotho from Lesotho and a Zulu person from KZN? I don't understand. What exactly are you? What's your view on all of this?
Can I just hop in quickly, Andre? That is so unfair, Pums, because it's not an either or.
What I'm trying to understand is the parameter?
I think he said he doesn't think that there shouldn't be any immigration.
Why are you explaining him? Let him speak for himself.
Well, all right.
I love the question. The there's nothing wrong with movement, with difference. I think those are truly necessary things. Imagine just South Africans trading with each other. I love your reference to that. Always, forever, just us, just trading with ourselves. That's so unhealthy, and you know that we've tried it in years gone by, and we, you know, we saw where that led to. When I say that immigration is should be done right, I think this whole lazy approach of, you know, there should be a global approach to immigration, that's nonsense. And every country or region should work at it. When I say it should be done right, we of course we need regulation, we need paperwork, we need control. People mustn't just walk across the boundaries of a country. Why are you here? Why do you need to come in? And that is a distinction, I think, between the movement that you mentioned. In Europe, I live in Germany, I go work in France, and I sign the contract with you in Italy. And there's very little restriction, you know, and we trade and we produce in one country and we sell in another. That's healthy. That's a clever way of dealing with the movement of people, of immigration, people wanting to follow, you know, new developments. I'm completely for that, and I'd like to see that done better here in South Africa and in the rest of the continent. But once, and I think maybe I wasn't clear on that, once we see what we see on the American borders and some European borders, and here to an extent where it's really just literally just join us if you want to, that is creating conflict, it's creating conflicts which we haven't seen the nasty side of. We're still here in South Africa. We're still forming them, and we've got no idea how bad this is going to get. I'm not sure if I was clearer there. I'll try again if you still prefer.
So, I mean, I think, and this is where I struggle predominantly with the idea of how we regulate this inter-movement of people. And this is why I believe that the root symptom of some of the conflicts that we see, particularly here in South Africa, is really around the fact that we have got a stagnant economy, and therefore all of this movement, there's not enough movement and exchange of goods and money between people, and therefore there is a clash. Because if I think about the USA, which is essentially a big block of states which have easy access to each other, so that people, the moving of skills, of people, of economy, of money, of goods, of all of that is easy. That is why they are such a big and powerful economy. If I think about a big land mass like China and the way that they are able to do that too, I mean, with a whole lot of other issues and central control from Beijing. But again, right, what I struggle with in Africa particularly is I struggle with the fact that because we have such weak governments, because we have such weak control systems, it is difficult to regulate and see who is coming in and out, what is coming in and out. And that the conflict then is really not so much a conflict of identity, rather because you have to find, when you are now competing for little resource, as we are here in South Africa, is you're suddenly going, well, if all the restaurants are only employing Zimbabweans and there are many South Africans who are unemployed, why are
there you touch on an identity conflict. Why can't Zimbabweans work at this foot?
No one is saying Zimbabweans cannot work at this foot. The conflict is not because they are Zimbabweans. It is the one way to identify this person that I am in a resource fight with. This person that is fighting for the same resource as me. How do I identify them? That is why when you have a black-white conflict, it is also because I have to be able to identify the other. And what is the otherness of this person? The otherness of this person is not that they are black. The otherness of this person is not that they are from Pimville versus Dube. The otherness of this person at this moment, the big one, the first big one, is that they are, and this is the danger where we are here in South Africa, is when there are no more Zimbabweans, then you have Zulus and Sotus fighting each other. We had a year ago a huge tavern shooting in Soweto where 15 people were mowed down. And because all of those people are in Soweto, all of those people are black. Now, when you look for the otherness that says, what is the conflict between these two people? You're suddenly saying, oh, these ones are Zamazamas. These ones are Xhosas. These ones are Zulus. And that is what I'm saying, because the underlying problem is not that they are Zulu. That's not what you are fighting with them about. You're fighting with them about the fact that you want this job and you believe because there is a otherness that you can put in the box that says Zimbabwean. You're not fighting with them because they're Zimbabwean. You're fighting with them because of the job.
But that's exactly identity conflict. That if the minute it's easier... The more prevalent examples are the black-white ones and the South Africans and Zimbabwe and so on. But the minute we're all made up of our identities, of our genders, our preferences. And the minute we have, the minute there's a me, there's an us. And the minute there's an us, there must be a them. And that's the beginning of all of these conflicts. The minute, and it doesn't have to be black and white. I think your example is a good one. The minute that we are, and this is where our politicians come in, and that's my second question. Do they know how these identity conflicts work, how not to persuade people, how to deal with it effectively, and still use these triggers and levers to start conflicts and to benefit in a political way from that. When they drive us into these silos of us and them, it doesn't always have to be black and white. It doesn't always have to be South African or the other. As long as there's an us and a them, there's benefit from conflict.
I think, you know, what Pumi said just now is hugely instructive, because in a battle of resources, people will find an other. And I think that's such an indictment on human nature, let alone anything else.
That's the problem with life is people.
Yeah. But let me ask you this, Andre, because this is your area of expertise and specialization. How good do you think South Africans are at conflict resolution? I think South Africans, from my limited experience, and that's all I can draw on in this respect, because I don't see a lot of it happening. Pumi's quite right that mostly, on the face of it, South Africans get along. We're not looking to fight with each other. People are not massively aggressive about things. Sure, you see a lot of protestation and noise on Twitter, but that's not the real world. Thank God. How well do you think South Africans do deal with conflict? Because we see, you know, little arguments break out here and there. And most people in South Africa, black and white, they back down. We're not a very confrontational bunch of people across the board, especially women, less confrontational by nature. That's a normal and kind of obvious distinction between men and women. But even in the workplace, you know, the average employee is frightened to ask their employer for X, Y, and Z. I don't know that we're that good at conflict resolution. Our politicians certainly aren't.
We avoid conflict.
Yeah.
We're pretty awful at conflict. And a lot of that has to do with our past. We are conflict avoidant. We suppress conflict. We are nice because I don't want to be unpopular. I don't want to be criticized. There's the black-white problem. There's the gender problem from a conflict perspective, in that we don't – how often do we have absolutely wonderfully open, honest conversations about race, about gender?
Only on this show.
Bless you for that. Bless you for that. This is the type of conversation we should have. So to answer your question, Gareth, I think we're pretty awful at conflicts. We either sue each other, blame each other, or ignore each other. That's not healthy conflict resolution. That's not really dragging things out into the sunshine and talking about it and getting to the sources of it. We're very quick to compromise. And modern conflict tells us that, you know, conflict is compromise is generally an awful way of resolving conflict.
Say that again. I like that. Just explain it after you've said it, because that is something people immediately look at how Pumi reacted. It's like, right. How can you say compromise is bad? Go on.
This is conflict management is guilty of, in the 80s, it was this nearly hippie approach to conflict where, you know, just play nice, smile, and mm-hmm. you know, burn incense and meet each other in the middle. That has changed It is now science-driven. It is multidisciplinary. And all of that, or the case studies, the science shows us that compromise is really, I love the, for me in my work, in my consulting work, really, compromise, a working definition is you give something away that you would have preferred to keep. And
everybody's equally unhappy.
It's this lazy, unskilled way of dealing with conflict, where you say 10, I want 5, so let's call it 7.5, and we go home. It's this lazy, unskilled way of dealing with conflict. It kicks the can down the road because
it comes from that stupid word fairness, and that is something that has never been a priority for human beings throughout our history. Fairness is not something humans are good at. You win, I lose. I win, you lose. That's how it works.
And those same case studies show us that the process of how we doing how we compromise, people would do themselves harm, as we see with coalition politics. They'll do themselves harm simply because it wasn't done fairly. The deal's not all that bad, but you were rude to me, or the process didn't. Compromise is an awful conflict strategy, and most of our politicians with all love and respect, that's all they know. It's a quick fix.
Our president is the best at this. He's constantly compromising. And listen, Pumi, I know how you feel about him.
But so my question then around big conflicts, right? Big conflicts, which is what communal conflicts are, which is what society conflicts are, which is what eventually wars are. At the point where there is no reasonable compromise on the table, and sometimes that compromise is you are afraid of me. Sometimes that compromise, I have a gun on the table and I'm not afraid to use it. This is where the tinderbox we're sitting in the Middle East is exactly that. Is and that to an extent is also compromise. Right. So is it really such a bad way to resolve conflict? Because if I think about how we resolve the conflict in our homes, with our children, with our spouses, with our families, that's one of the ways of being able to move to the next thing. And where you are unwilling to compromise, then you are consistently in this push and pull where the tension between the two is always ready to erupt. So why is compromise bad?
This is back to Gareth's question about how are we as South Africans with conflict. What we need is creative solutions. We need to work at solutions and not just compromise. Now, often, let's take the ever-present example of coalition politics. A certain level, a type of compromise is necessary. I can't have it all my way. I have to give you some things to get some things. At that level, some of it is good. But the way we put it together, the processes we put it together, that lazy, cut the cake in half approach to it is creating the problems. What we need to do is unpack those conflicts, explain, really escalate the conflict, share that information properly, create solutions, not just compromise solutions.
Sorry, Andre, can I just suggest that one of the ways that we could look at this too is that men and women deal with conflict differently. And I'm sure you've done a lot of research into this too. This is probably part of the way that you present yourself in the business world with solutions for other people's problems. Women like a cooperative compromise. Men do not. It is not in our nature to cut the cake in half and say, well, there, that's fair, now let's move on, right? It's a big difference.
You'll be surprised. Women are not, the statistics simply don't bear that out. Women are not that great. They don't lean towards compromise as much as we think they do.
Think about the most war stories you've heard.
Exactly.
This is why we, for example, back to the topic of Africa and the conflicts there, migration and so on. We are starting to find case studies show how involving women, and this isn't a woke speech, this is simple science, include women in conflicts, and you see better results at yeah. grassroots level. In Africa, yep. they're not, you know, they're excluded or they're patted on the head. I'm excluding South Africa here. But include yeah. women and bring that. And that is the joy and the beauty of scientific conflict management. Well, use the tools, not as BEE box ticking exercises, not as woke talking points, but as scientific tools that you can use to your benefit to resolve the conflict in a way that's not just a cut the cake in the middle.
Well, excluding 50% of the population is no way to ensure that 100% of the population sticks to whatever the decision is.
Exactly. And women have a different way of approaching conflict. And that's not necessarily as gentle and as prone towards compromise as we may think, but it's a difference, and that is what as South Africans we really need to relook and absolutely reinvent ourselves, the way we do our conflict. And our politicians are just absolutely, for various good and bad reasons, they're just absolutely awful at just having the knowledge and the bravery, the courage to. We've got some serious complex problems and conflicts, and you see the same approach, the same speeches, the same promises, and guess what? The same results. Our coalitions are the same tired old thing. We just stir the pot and hope for the best.
Is there anything that we can learn from the way that we resolve interpersonal relationship one-on-one conflicts that we can learn from that we can scale up to better resolve conflicts in our communities?
There's a lot of that that does scale up. At some point, some of the dynamics change and some of the dynamics collapse, where the way that interpersonal conflict a rule that is good advice in interpersonal conflict won't work as well or at all in group or even national conflict dynamics, such as your identity conflict situation. But certainly, yeah, there's some wonderful lessons. Depends on who you speak to. You know, what is the problem on the table? There's certainly some very, very wonderful and inspiring parallels from our interpersonal. For example, dignity, care, and don't compromise. Love the other one enough to stop compromising. Let's work at this rather. Let me understand, why are you angry with me? Why don't you want to live with me? Why don't you want to work with me? Let me understand that so we can truly solve it, as opposed to saying, from Monday, we're not going to be nasty to each other. That type of approach.
Whenever I think of South Africans having a conflict, it reminds me of Chris Marileng and that guy with the "Don't touch me on your studio." And I think, yeah, you know, that is such a perfect example of like an effete, pointless, dumb conflict between two people where there's just like nobody really knows what to do. And schoolyard. I see so much of that. Yeah, schoolyard. I see that a lot in South Africa. It's kind of ridiculous. So I think maybe we should focus also on trying not to get into conflict situations in the first place. But when necessary, understand how to behave in those conflicts.
Gareth, we need better conflicts, not less conflicts.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't even want to get started with what a better conflict is. But I do think I am a little bit sad that over the years, South Africa and South Africans, South Africa as a you know, as a unitary body in the world body, and South Africans on a one-on-one level in our communities. And we have degenerated and regressed to a place where we don't do it so well. I think we had an opportunity. There was a time where South Africa really could have taught the world what
we should be so good at. We should be so good at conflict, isn't it? But then,
that there are other ways of moving forward, that there are other ways of moving from where you are to the next level, even in the discomfort. Even in the discomfort, I think South Africans learned early in the 90s, where, again, at a knife edge, how to live in the discomfort and find a way to move to the next level. And we had economic growth, and we had a relatively stable society and stuff working. And somewhere in the past 15 years, we have degenerated.
I love the question, because and we can tie that to your earlier reference to parallels between personal and more group conflict. If you and I have the same problems, and whatever I do, whatever I speak to you, whatever I ask you, whatever proposals I have, it always ends the same, then after a while, I do start giving up. Pumi's really not listening. She doesn't understand me. She doesn't want to do this better. And you know, I start looking at alternatives. This is conflict fatigue. And 30 years on, we are so fatigued with. We start with unskillful, very ineffective conflict methods. We argue with each other. We shout at each other. We swear at each other. We form these little toxic little groups, and now those cycles run and run and run and run, always with predictable results. You can see exactly how it's going to end, like the next coalition politics. You see the promises and you see the result months before it ends, and that is conflict fatigue. And those cycles will never break because we keep on being bad at conflict. We live with our politicians. Their inability to be effective at conflict. If a party in South Africa who really looks at this, and I speak to them as individuals, and we can just not get it to an organizational level. If you understand the levers and the piano wires of identity conflicts, for example, you'd really be able to persuade people a lot more effectively. You'd be able to transcend these conflicts.
Guys, I'm going to have to draw this to a close because otherwise we'll end up in a conflict. But thank you for joining us on the Burning Platform. Andre, lovely to have you on the show and to be able to put a face and a voice to the tweets, as Pumi said earlier. Pumis, we will see you next week for more of the Burning Platform.
And thank you
to the comments section, who have been on fire this morning too, with lots of very, very wise and interesting things being said there too. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of your comments. We will see you next week right here on the podcast party, The Burning Platform. Ciao.